So, good morning. I'm Josephine Ensign, and I'm here today with Noah Fay from Downtown Emergency Services Center. Thank you so much for agreeing to talk with me. And it is Friday, June 24th, 2022. So, Noah, as we were talking a little bit before this is for my Skid Road / Way Home project. That's kind of a public scholarship project with about the history of and now the contemporary landscape of homelessness and healthcare in Seattle and King County. So what led you to the work that you do?
Yeah, that's a great often asked question that I honestly struggle to answer a bit. I've reflected on it a lot. I have had an interest in poverty, I think, and have really been drawn to people and thinking about people who have a lot less than me. I started doing work just kind of on a volunteer basis to support homelessness when I was in high school. Recall organizing car washes to donate money to local charities.
Was that in the Seattle area?
Yeah, a little nearby on Bainbridge Island where I went to high school, just across the sound from Seattle. Then I had the opportunity in college. I worked a bit for WashPerg, Public Interest Research Group, doing some of their, not formally work, volunteered for, but did work there. And one of the initiatives was always around housing and homelessness, which got me a little bit more connected to some of the Seattle-based services. Did some work, I recall, at the Union Gospel Mission, doing volunteer work. And enjoyed that, found it interesting, did some advocacy work. But then the real kind of tipping point for me, I think, was I was required to do a volunteer student service project as part of a large University of Washington, 500-person sociology course. And we got a list of all the places around the city of Seattle that had a relationship with the UW, and they weren't all focused on housing and homelessness at all. But I was particularly drawn to volunteer at an organization that was. And my first choice was the Needle Exchange because it seemed cutting edge.
The Frauen or the
I honestly don't remember. I didn't get it. That's how I recall. Gotcha. I was drawn to it. And my second choice was DESC, which is where I am now. I didn't have the language to describe harm reduction back then, but clearly it was in my heart, given that's what I was drawn to volunteering at, and started volunteering at DESC in the evenings, doing work at our coffee counter in our large congregate shelter that had been open since the 70s, and immediately fell in love with the work, the staff doing the work, and then more than anything was just drawn to the people we were serving. I struggle to sometimes put the right language to this, or the language I like, but I find myself thinking, I don't think I would have known that those were people in our community if I hadn't started working there, and was just blown away by the complexity, the creativity, the sense of humor, and the deep, deep challenges those folks were living with, and just fell in love with the work and basically haven't left.
And then you went back for like public administration and things like that, thinking that that's the kind of work that you wanted to do?
Yeah, I did direct service for quite a while in our shelter program, street outreach, mental health street outreach, which was the coolest job I will have ever have in my life. I knew it when I was doing it. I knew it when I left, I was leaving the coolest job I'll ever have, but wanted to try to do a little bit more leadership, management, administrative work, and slowly did that in different roles and eventually got to a place where it seemed like it would be really helpful for me to get a master's degree. So I returned to the University of Washington and got a master's in public administration from the Evans School in 2016.
Great. So tell me a little bit about the job that you have now in terms of being in charge of housing. What does that all entail?
So my role, I'm the housing director at DESC right now. I've been in that role for 4 years. That means I oversee all of our permanent supportive housing programming and our entry services or shelter programming, as people probably would more be familiar with that term. So I'm responsible for ensuring, in two big buckets really, the property management of running apartment buildings for people in housing programs, and the programs themselves for the physical programs for entry services also, and then ensuring service delivery for people living in those programs. And so there's a lot of interplay between those two dynamics, but you know, I would say certainly the priority is ensuring appropriate service delivery for people and finding a way to do whatever it takes to help people stay housed. DESC, what I love about this organization, the two things that I would always point to is that we really are super committed to serving the most vulnerable people we can find, and our programs are reflected based on their needs. I love that about our programming. And then on the tail end of that is we really do whatever it takes to try to make it work for people, which I also really love about our programming. That means it's also pretty hard.
Yes. So a lot of people that just have so many challenges, and as on one side people would say are service resistant or
right.
hesitant or all of that.
Yep.
And so tell me, with the shelter, which
yeah.
I've been, I guess it's a used to be above our heads in the,
yep.
in the ballroom of the Morrison, old Morrison Hotel. So it obviously closed down at the beginning of the pandemic for public health reasons. And it hasn't reopened. So can you tell me some of the decision making and thinking mm-hmm. that DESC has had about that?
Yeah, happily. So we'd actually been thinking for quite some time before the pandemic about what is the right way to think about shelter. Frankly, we don't want to be running shelter. It's
mm-hmm.
an unfortunate necessity of the lack of affordable and accessible housing in our community, and always has been. And because that need is there, we're committed to doing it with a particular focus on shelter that meets the needs of what some people call service resistant folks, which is not a term we use,
mm-hmm.
but people with the highest needs.
Mm-hmm.
So we create low barrier shelter programming. And we've done that for a long time. Our model had historically been, because shelter is a survival resource and not having it is potentially a life-threatening scenario for people, do whatever we can to get as many people inside as we could. And we did that for a really long time. Which invariably saved thousands of lives over the decades we did it. However, the space was pretty high stress,
mm-hmm.
pretty crowded,
yeah,
pretty chaotic.
Mm-hmm.
And we could, as our thinking evolved over the years, is that the right balance to strike? And so we started exploring ideas of balancing quantity versus quality of the space. So
mm-hmm.
do we maybe not maximize the number of people who can be in the space, trading that instead for creating a space that is a little bit more trauma-informed, gives people a platform to potentially recover in a way a crowded, cramped space
mm-hmm.
doesn't. So we've explored that with some of our newer shelter programmings, the Navigation Center, the West Wing. But then when the pandemic hit, we had the responsibility and opportunity to get people out of that crowded space
mm-hmm.
Of the old shelter programming. So we partnered with King County and the City of Seattle to move people out into less congregate settings, most notably into hotel rooms, which
mm-hmm.
were available because no one was traveling. A number of cities have done that. And we noticed immediately that people, in some cases, staff used terms, literally the term unrecognizable to them, a term for people that we've known for years upon years.
Mm-hmm.
Seemingly overnight presented differently in ways that largely attributed to the fact that they had the space and autonomy to plan their lives in a way that just are not afforded in a crowded bunk bed dynamic where you're waiting in line for your next meal. You always have to keep your stuff with you. You're worried about things getting stolen.
Mm-hmm.
Where am I going to put my things? You're worried about the person next to you who has got their own set of struggles and they're playing out in a very public way. All things most people don't have to deal with. And by moving people into a space where they had that privacy, we saw people overnight start sleeping better, talking about how they were able to handle their hygiene needs differently, feeling better in terms of overall mental health, starting to plan for their future in a way that they,
mm-hmm.
some people would articulate this, others not as much, but they just didn't have the brain space to do because they were fighting day in, day out for, you know, getting basic survival needs met.
Right.
So frankly, then that should be surprising to us. That is the housing
mm-hmm.
first model.
Right, and housing is healthcare.
But to see it happen overnight was just so remarkably profound that we immediately said, we're not going back. We are not going back to this crowded space. And luckily, we got a lot of positive reaction to that. And actually, you're interviewing me on an appropriate day. We literally just opened up the permanent replacement for the old main shelter space yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
It is up and running. And so now moving forward, people seeking emergency shelter options that historically would have had no option other than a bunk bed upstairs, now have a permanent resource that will be a private room to their own while we help people find a permanent housing resource.
Wow, so the shelter space has been converted into private rooms.
No, the shelter space upstairs is actually sitting empty.
Hmm.
We found a different space. So
we
were in two hotels. We worked with King County through the Health Through Housing Program and found
mm-hmm.
two hotels and stood them up over the last few months. So one opened late last year and the other opened yesterday.
Wow. Yeah. Well, congratulations. Thank you. Good news.
Yeah, it's pretty remarkable to think. And that we weren't sure if we're going to be able to pull that off, but we still, you know, there is still a challenge here where there's not our, the two guiding principles we were planning to use to do this were maximizing autonomy and privacy is a guiding principle for shelter. We've done that, but we also didn't want to lose capacity in the system for high needs people. We haven't done that. We have actually lost capacity, and I think we're seeing that play out on the streets of Seattle right now, particularly for people with really high needs. I would never want to invest shelter before housing, but at the same time, while we are trying to scale up housing, which I think we're doing more as a community now than ever, still not enough, but we're doing more than ever, we still need some space for people to go. There's a big investment in outreach, which is great. I used to do outreach. You need somewhere to outreach people too. You can't just do the outreach.
Right. So tell me what some of what you're seeing and what some of the philosophy is of DESC staff and yourself included, obviously, in terms of encampment clearances.
Oh, it's a tough one. So yeah, encampments are kind of a new phenomenon for us and as a community, but as for DSC is how I'm thinking about that, where we have always had a dynamic where we're doing active street outreach for people who, for any number of reasons, can't, won't, or unable to access what shelter resources they are, maybe quite simply because they're just full or that the shelters are too high barrier for people to get into, they can't meet the criteria to get in. Or there's too high stress, which is, as I touched on earlier, totally a legitimate dynamic. What we haven't seen before, except now that we're seeing more and more in the last few years, is kind of established groups of people living in that condition as opposed to individuals. That is difficult for us to try to figure out how best to support people in that situation, because we want to We want to respect people for making the choices that are best for them, but we also are not okay accepting that people should live in tents on the street corner, and that's a bit of a fine line, especially when talking externally with the general public. So I am not a fan of sweeps, but I am not a fan of simply saying we need to leave people where they are and leave them be. That is just neither of those are good alternatives, and neither of those are all that, I think, informed by what we know works for people. So sweeps on their own are usually highly disruptive for people. There are plenty of people who essentially hit the reset button after they've been swept because they lose their stuff, not to mention
ID and everything, medications.
I mean, one of the driving forces behind encampments, from talking to teams that are still doing outreach — I don't do outreach anymore, so I'm playing a poser a bit right now — but it's the sense of community that people have, the sense of safety in numbers, which makes all the sense in the world. That gets disrupted when people move, all of that. And there's already such a feeling of insecurity when you don't have a place to live. Losing it time and time again is inherently pretty traumatic. I think the term, the expression of just squeezing the balloon, is one that I point to around sweeps. When we move people, all we're doing is just moving moving people to a different space.
That's a better metaphor than whack-a-mole.
Totally, yeah. Yep, exactly, yeah. Violent. Yeah, yeah, for sure. But I also think we're short-sighted, and we're not doing ourselves any services as service providers if we are just adamantly saying no sweeps and not saying what should come instead.
Right.
And that happens a lot, and that I feel like is a missed opportunity to point to that we have a evidence-based model that resolves sweeps, or resolves encampments, and resolves chronic homelessness for people in a way that is time-tested, evidence-based. We just don't have enough of it.
Right.
So I think I really feel this way. I just had these conversations recently in pockets around Seattle and communities that are upset about encampments, and we lean into those conversations to support our neighbors where we have programs. And I genuinely mean it. I'm as equally frustrated as most neighbors, maybe not all neighbors, but I'm equally frustrated about the situation before us. I might disagree with what the solution is than most neighbors, but we should all agree it is unacceptable that people are living in tents in any city in America, let alone one that has the wealth that we have. There's a colleague of mine who I work with at the county who says, you know, the state of homelessness is inherently unacceptable, except for, of course, that we accept it. And
right. Yeah, it just becomes part of the background.
Yep.
Gritty, urban, authentic.
Yep,
right?
Exactly.
So can you tell me a little bit about what you saw? I mean, obviously it was towards the beginning of the pandemic and, you know, de-intensifying and shelters and having, you know, public health guidance on stopping or slowing the spread for your guests and for your staff members. But then what did you all see during CHAZ and CHOP?
Oh, interesting. Go to the Wayback Machine.
Yeah, summer of 2020 into the fall.
The public health stuff, maybe answer that felt more palpable. I'm trying to think if really the CHAZ and CHOP, what relation that had to our work.
Like, did any of the outreach team go there?
They did. I don't remember their experience all that well, and I would be mm-hmm. a little second, mm-hmm. third hand. I think to the public health stuff, just briefly, I mean, I think to me it was this amazing, profound example of, like, the guidance was stay at home and keep your distance. And we're running a whole bunch of programs that by definition, neither of those two things were possible.
Right.
And it just really highlighted, like, the power of your own space in a way that usually we're talking about it from an individual level. We hadn't talked about it from a public health perspective before, in most cases at least. And it just really hit home just how critical that is for folks. Around that, yeah, CHAZ and CHOP, I know there our teams did some outreach up there. I don't really recall how it went. I know there was some concern for ensuring people had sufficient supports. That got mm-hmm. tricky at times as that situation evolved. I don't know if I have much more to say than that.
Okay, so it wasn't like...
It was a thing that was happening in the city at the same time, but
right.
we didn't feel a deep impact on our day-to-day at all.
Yeah, with the... You know, significant encampment that they grew up around that, including, you know, some of your at least former clients
yep.
involved with that. So tell me a little bit, this might be a little hot button, but when you're talking about, you know, public perception, your, you know, the internal, like, DESC thinking discussions about the modeling and de-intensifying or, like, closing the shelter.
Yeah.
What effect did Como's you know, Seattle's Dying and Fight for the Soul of Seattle have? Because I know they really dissed DESC, but
yep.
without having DESC people having an opportunity to speak.
Yeah, those are really unfortunate pieces of film. The term misery pornography was
mm-hmm,
used.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was a pretty good one.
Yeah.
I heard that term.
Yeah, Tim Harris, yeah.
Tim, that was Tim, yeah. Spot on. What impact did it have? I feel like if anything, one, it hurts to see people
mm-hmm.
suffering portrayed that way.
Right. Yeah.
I think there's a real dynamic in this work for our staff who do this work. The challenge is so great. The resource lags behind it so much. And then the individual needs of people are so complex. Seeing those kind of just put to bear
mm-hmm.
in a way that was the opposite of sympathetic and compassionate,
mm-hmm.
I think really hurt, because I think there's this dynamic here that is in this line of work, that there's always a risk for individual moral injury, where people,
mm-hmm.
they want to help, that's why we're here. And sometimes there's not enough help to really get people,
right.
you know, the support they need. And then seeing that play out in a way that is meant to kind of undermine the efforts to support people and instead villainize them, I think created probably, it did for me at least, it hurt
mm-hmm.
on an individual level. I think it definitely put a bit of a spotlight on our work. Then I think that did one of two things, to overgeneralize. One, I think it galvanized people and to say, hell yeah, this work.
Mm-hmm.
The people we serve have dignity and rights, and we
mm-hmm.
know how to serve them, and back off in a way that I think kind of, you know, rallied people a bit. And then on the other hand, just the opposite happened, or felt demoralizing, especially because it got so much attention. Invariably,
really?
People who do this work, their family members and friends know they do this work, and they get bombarded with questions. Some of them are just well-intentioned questions. Often those aren't always framed in ways that make you feel good about your work, and others are far more kind of nefarious in their intent of trying to
mm-hmm.
kind of...
Gotcha.
Yeah, gotcha questions, for sure. So I think it created a real sense that we should be what's the right way to fight back on that narrative, and how to fight back, and how to fight back respectfully, how to fight back in a way that doesn't give oxygen to something that really doesn't deserve it, because it's there's not a there. You know, it'd be one thing if it was a critique of programs' effectiveness in a way that's based in science, research, and evidence, but just a reactionary film like that, how much should we engage on that or not, definitely came up, I think, which was tricky. But one thing that I also that came out of it was, I think my experience has been from elected officials and from public funders was a full-throated endorsement of evidence-based models and not caving to this, which is really great, a really kind reinforcement of the things that we know that work, and not caving to what political pressure there may have been.
Right, yeah. Let's put homeless people at McNeil Island. It's pretty inflammatory. So so that also leads me to, and I, you know, going to the Housing First, the Partners Conference, which was great, hearing what people, you know, internationally even, across the country and here in Seattle are dealing with. And then doing a little bit of discourse analysis, right, of what's going on in the public discourse and politicians. And with our current mayor, with Harrell, looking at his plan for homelessness, plan for dealing with homelessness, coming, you know, when he was running for mayor, of using Housing First in a way that for me felt a little like, is that really Housing First? Of I don't remember the exact quote, but I have it at home, but of saying that his how they were dealing with encampment clearances was with a Housing First approach. Have you all run into things like that, not necessarily with with Mayor Harrell, with others, kind of appropriating this? Yeah, because we're, as a city at least, we love evidence-based, and we're actually pretty science, public health minded, but a misappropriating, misusing the term.
Oh yeah, most definitely the term Housing First gets used in ways that don't appear to be tied to the underpinning principles that really make the model both meaningfully how it's been designed, but then also the evidence-based model it is. You can't pick and choose from the principles and still think it's the evidence-based program that it is. So I've definitely heard and experienced that in my work over the last 18 years. I did some work up and down the West Coast, to some consulting work, definitely would see examples of programs, you know, plastering the label Housing First, but then usually comes down to, I mean, it's rare that then there are, you know, formal restrictions that somebody enroll in a program to move in, or that people who don't, you know, meet with a case manager are evicted. That stuff, I haven't seen examples of that. However, there's a lot of stuff that moves away from that really low barrier, client-centered, tenant-centered approach that is critical. Services seem to become less voluntary, difficult behaviors are less welcomed and tolerated. There's a kind of a core component of like an inherent collaborative, pragmatic, problem-solving approach that has to be part of the Housing First approach if you want to help people who've got great needs stay housed. I've seen programs not do a whole lot of that. There are certainly a lot of examples of programs that will purport to be Housing First. I think mean and tend to be Housing First, but then create often administrative, sometimes service barriers upon entry, but usually administrative ones. So are people being asked to comply with screening interviews? Are people having to fill out criminal background checks in a way that might screen them out? All that stuff, that definitely still exists. So I think, It's a good problem to have, I think, in that the idea of Housing First
at least it's on people know what it
totally
if they don't understand the whole meaning of it, but at least they know it's a thing and it's evidence based.
At least locally, you can successfully apply to run programs if you don't embrace a Housing First approach. That was not always the case, so that's a great place to be. Finding a place to the next step is ensuring people keep fidelity to the model. I'd rather have that problem than the other one of not having that be a requirement in the first place. But yes, for sure, that's a challenge.
Right. Okay. And then I had a question about your vulnerability index that I got a copy of
Sure.
at the conference, and I was going through it, and applying it, I mean, this is theoretical, right? But applying it with some clients, some guests, some patients that I've worked with. And you know, I think it's in that also, I know it's evidence-based, which is really good. It's been tested and refined. One of the things that struck me, and maybe I just missed it, but because I work with a lot of female clients and LGBTQ identified, you know, young people, and I didn't see in there, especially around like sexual assault and the risk of that on the streets or, you know, in different kinds of housing or shelter options. I didn't see where that was factored in. Did I just miss that, or is that?
I wouldn't say you just missed it, but it is factored in a more kind of nebulous way.
That's what I was wondering.
Yeah, so just a point of clarification, because it can be a sore spot. So ours is the vulnerability assessment tool. Mm-hmm. The vulnerability index often gets confused with a different assessment tool, the VI-SPADAT, they're completely separate. So important to clarify. So for the vulnerability assessment tool. So yeah, how we address, well, two things. The historic vulnerability assessment tool that we developed in the early 2000s as a way to prioritize high needs people to get priority access to the shelter, and it's just grown from there, has these 10 domains. One of them is around survival skills, and the others are around social behaviors that speak to that. And it describes people's ability to interact safely with others for any number of root cause reasons. And that's where issues like that would come up. So if somebody would struggle to navigate safely in the community for any number of different reasons and is more likely to potentially be preyed upon by others, that would drive up the score. That's where that falls in. That said, the second piece is we have been doing some work in the last few years on more intentionally incorporating equity principles into the tool to maybe be more explicit about the impacts of identity and risk factors, and maybe calling out those issues as opposed to maybe more nuanced root causes that could be tied to any number of different things that drive somebody's level of vulnerability. So I think there's more work we're doing on that, but that's where those issues usually live.
That's what I was surmising, but I just wanted to make sure that was correct, what I was teasing out. And then the other thing that, you know, I know it's related, and of course I'm just blanking on the name, but the uniform, like the intake form, the one for being able to match people with housing options. Yes, there we go. So that one, and this kind of gets to your philosophy background, I think, too, and your work, that I've struggled with is between the people who are newly homeless, like a young woman who becomes homeless, living in her car or something, and then and that versus like somebody with like chronic homelessness, and maybe she's not, you know, dealing with a serious substance use disorder, maybe some depression, but not like super, you know, disabling. That the person with, you know, with chronic homelessness gets priority. How does the DESC deal with that?
I've seen there were a lot of articles covering access to housing through coordinated entry resources, both locally and across the community. And that point comes up a lot about, like, is the system designed in such a way that you have to wait to have a lot of things go wrong before you get any help? And I understand that critique. I sometimes struggle with the words on this. I almost flip that perspective, like the system, we didn't create a system to then go find people to plug into it. We built a bunch of resources because there's this overwhelming demand for a place for people to live. And so the resource hasn't ever come close to the demand. So when the resources are super scarce, who should get it? And well, the person with the greatest needs has always been that's been DSE's philosophy. It's the philosophy of coordinated entry system, how we define greatest need. There's a long, not academic conversation. Can get academic, but it's not. It's very pragmatic and has real consequence. The other piece I would say too is, that's particularly relevant for DSC, is that we intentionally design our programs in such a way that they are built and staffed to meet people's, to meet the needs of people who, without those resources, are unlikely to successfully stay housed. So it's super important to us that that's who we find and we prioritize. I would say that is the fact that the point you're pointing out around, does this tool adequately elevate, does it disproportionately elevate somebody who's experienced homelessness a lot longer than somebody else? Yeah, for sure, mm-hmm. it does. I think, and the reason for that is just tied to the trauma people experience experiencing homelessness for an extended period. I think that is definitely true. And I think the other thing that is, I think, important to call out that is not always clear when we talk about the homeless response system, which we have more of a system now than ever. Mm-hmm. Still, system's probably a little generous of a term, but there's a huge donut hole in the middle of resources we have in our community. So we've got more, we've got, I don't know if I'd say adequate, but we have a lot of resource on the very front end for people who fall into homelessness, largely maybe for economic reasons or mm-hmm. for some time-limited reason, and we can use a rapid rehousing resource or a diversion resource to help somebody quickly get back on their feet mm-hmm. and allow them to get back on the path to paying market rate rent on their own, and off they go.
Right.
We've got not enough, but more, and that's what DSC specializes in, and resources for people who need a permanent rental subsidy and permanent support to be able to access their housing. If you are in the middle where you need a permanent rental subsidy, but you don't need permanent supports, mm-hmm. there's almost nothing for you. There's been recent investments with some emergency housing vouchers, but that doesn't come close to describing the example, I think, of maybe the hypothetical you were talking about of somebody mm-hmm. who, you know, may be living with some form of disability, may not be able to get back into the workforce, may not be able to get a job that adequately pays enough for rent, or has other life circumstances that means they need some financial support and maybe some light touch help.
Mm-hmm.
Those resources are
non-existent,
gone.
Right?
Not yet.
And then they were really non-existent during the beginning of the pandemic, is what I gather from a lot of service providers.
Yep.
That makes sense. Let me see what my other questions. I know that DESC has a long-standing relationship. I'm sure there are ups and downs with that relationship, but in terms of King County Detention Center and mm-hmm. you know, people cycling into jail, really, you know, high needs, chronic homelessness kinds of things. What, if anything, like in terms of the coordination with clients that you've been mm-hmm. serving, and then with discharge planning. And what, if anything, exists in terms of really meaningful substance use disorder and or mental health treatment while someone's in jail for any length of time?
Yeah, obviously. For sure. I'm dating myself answering this question in probably a sufficient way. That definitely was something I could talk in spades about in my direct service days, and maybe closer to even supervising case management teams. In my role these days, and then exacerbated by the pandemic, where the jail, people aren't going to jail the way they used to,
right.
Which is, you know, all but a good thing. I would say we've established relationships with a few outpatient programs at DSC that specialize with people who go in and out of jail
mm-hmm.
or otherwise would go in and out of jail if we didn't refer them onto these programs. So not a formal like lead program, but programs that work with people that are good candidates for those mm-hmm. sorts of programs that cycle either between inpatient hospital stays, forensic hospital stays, sometimes even, and then the jail that have great effect. The jail historically, and I mean, this is historic now, so this is probably not that helpful. Jail health was a deep partnership of ours. We've long had deep relationships with a lot of, particularly the prescribers who worked mm-hmm. in jail health, who really have done some pretty amazing work with pretty limited resource. Where, you know, for example, if somebody is arrested and is in jail and has a medication regimen, which is, you know, important to maintain, we would work closely with them to keep that going in jail. A lot of risk that falls apart just for, you know, sometimes communication breaks down, people aren't aware where people land. And then just the fact that the jail serves as one of our largest psychiatric facilities is tragic mm-hmm. and unacceptable, but mm-hmm. true nonetheless. And so that was one of the examples in the past. I've heard recently that there's some interest, I don't know at what level, if it's state corrections or local, around your substance use question to mm-hmm. really start thinking about exploring opportunities to start people on mm-hmm. medication assisted treatment in jail programs. I'm pretty sure our local jail does that or prioritizes that, which is just a great option for people. So right. that's a movement in the right direction, but invariably getting arrested, going to jail serves as knocking people backwards on whatever path they were on, mm-hmm. whether they were already housed or living on the streets, has always been my experience.
Right, right. Yes, and then there's meth.
Oh, gosh.
And then there's meth. We won't go into that.
Meth is kicking our ass, yep.
Yeah, I heard, yep. I can't remember her name, but the woman, it was at the conference who was talking about like even the decontamination and
yep.
what has to happen in some of the units.
It's one of those things where it is super present. People don't seem to know a lot about it. It scares people and people make decisions based on fear, mm-hmm. which I totally understand. I mean, you know, there's something about that substance, well, not that substance, but stimulants, of which it is clearly a powerful one, that presents more chaos mm-hmm. and visible chaos mm-hmm. and dysfunction than other substances. And so people's reaction to that is just therefore different. Mm-hmm. And I understand that. And we're dealing with the consequences of that. That's right. A real challenge
and
for us.
And the unpredictability, which feeds totally. Into the whole ongoing long-term fear of people
yep.
who are in poverty and homeless.
I think methamphetamine has harmed our ability to have community conversations mm-hmm. more than it gets credit. It's a very different conversation with the general public on how you support somebody sleeping off a binge drinking episode or nodding off in a doorway than it is somebody who is high on meth for 10 hours. It just creates a different public discourse mm-hmm. in a way that I think has made things harder.
Yes, and much different, at least from my perspective as a nurse, public health nurse, from some of like the first meth things that were happening. It's almost like a totally different drug now. So you've touched on some of this, but like could you speak to positives or things that really make you hopeful about this? I mean, you've talked about mm-hmm. at least where people in our community are understand or recognize like Housing First, some of the evidence-based models, some of the lessons, the positive lessons maybe of the pandemic, but others that kind of give you hope that keep you coming back every day?
Well, I mean, at the end of the day, I mean, because I know this works and I get to see it. I'm privileged enough to have been here for a long time and have worked with people in a lot of different capacities. We have 14 individual permanent supportive housing locations, and I do my best to get out to them as much as I can. And it's not uncommon that I see somebody that I knew when I was working swing shift in the main shelter in mm-hmm. 2005. And they are unrecognizable mm-hmm. in all but the sense that I can actually recognize
right,
them.
Right,
but
right.
in terms of how they're doing, light years. The thing that I think is hard to tell that story and to kind of keep us, that's why I pointed to the privilege of being here for a long time, it is mm-hmm. they are still obviously in most cases dealing with some pretty major challenges mm-hmm. in their life that are likely permanent and chronic and debilitating in some cases. However, they are in most cases dramatically different circumstances, dramatically more positive circumstances than they were when I knew them decades ago. And that story is what keeps me coming back to this. This work is profound, and people really do get better. We have to be comfortable with more.
What better means.
Exactly, flexible definitions of what better means mm-hmm. and recognizing it can take some time and it's non-linear, as everyone says, but it works. And that is really cool because in most cases, those same people I'm talking about are people that we had all but been given up on and had not been considered folks that were worthy of support, had a chance to recover, and this shows that that's just not true, that they do. But we have to be cool with, you know, embracing this model and recognize that it's gonna take some time. But given that, we see people get better. So mm-hmm. that, I love that. I mean, it's truly, really reinvigorating to see that. Try to tell that story to our staff. That's mm-hmm. harder when you've been here for 6 months and you're mm-hmm. seeing people mm-hmm. in chaos and living through, you know, challenging experiences and actively experiencing trauma and trying to step back and see the bigger picture. That's hard. And so, you know, I think one thing that I feel is positive is there's a lot of good energy around doing this work from a lot of committed, passionate people. I'm optimistic that we've got the attention of lawmakers, that we need to pay them like the professionals they are and find a path to allow people to do direct service as a career. I want people to be able to stay in this line of work and do direct service the way teachers can be a teacher for their
own
career.
Or nurses, right.
Exactly. And that's not a realistic option in this line of work.
It's true.
I've done it for 18 years and I'm an administrator now. I couldn't have had a family or bought a house doing direct service work, and that's not acceptable in this line of work. And so how do we take that positive energy and allow people to make it a career so that they can be there for those same people I was talking about over those years as they see people get better?
Yeah, and that's where their passion and their abilities are as well.
Exactly.
Yeah, and I know that in this last legislative session that did get passed, along with that health and homelessness, using Medicaid for Apple Health and Homes and other kinds of things.
Yep, exactly. Nice. So that momentum's in the right direction. The momentum around permanent supportive housing is the solution to chronic homelessness. That seems to be a largely settled debate, at least in the rooms that seem to matter the most, which is great. I think the path to scaling that is super unclear. It seems more promising this year than it did last, and then the year before that. So I'm optimistic that momentum can carry. So,
right, getting rid of, or at least decreasing some of the barriers in terms of having that happen more quickly.
Yep.
Right.
Yeah. And prioritizing investment. I mean, we've got one, getting commitment to the scale of need and just calling that out. Like, what would it take to end homelessness? Let's stop chipping away at the margins and creating one more program, one more team to do some outreach, but rather have a conversation around what would it cost to do that.
Mm-hmm.
We're not there yet, but there's some communities who have done that, and I think that's inspiring, and we could strive to just be that full-throated and saying what it takes to do this.
Mm-hmm.
I think that actually might be more well-received than some of the piecemeal stuff that often happens by the general public. Another point, but I lost it, but that's good.
Well, and it's also, for me, exciting that DESE, working with kind of more suburban areas within King County, like Burien, to have units, and where that probably is more challenging. I mean, I know Sophia Aragon, she's a nurse as well as the mayor there, and talking with her about her role in that, to me is encouraging, it seems.
Yep. Totally agree. Yeah, that the between King County's Health Through Housing Initiative and the new Regional Homeless Authority, there's a real endorsement of taking a regional response. Easier said than done, but I'm glad that's what we're putting forward.
And also at least working towards having people with lived experience heading, not just being tokens at the table.
Exactly.
It seems like that's
encouraging.
I agree. Right. So the next, anything else that I haven't asked you that you'd like to include, especially around your path within all of this and what you kind of see for the future?
Oh, I'm sure I'd just go on and on and on. But I don't, I would say that one thing that I don't know if I actually use this term, but I find myself saying a lot, is that there seems to be, and I'm getting old enough now, where I can say what's old is new again, where I've actually seen cycles of things, not just heard about them. And that is so true. And some of the debate about what to do around homelessness. And it is easy to get lost in that. And one thing I really love about DSC and my role now as the housing director, I don't get to just be a part of it, I get to really try to lead it, is blocking out that noise and staying laser focused on the stuff that we know that works. And feeling confident that's the direction we're gonna go is, I think, probably my path here. There's a bit of a helpful self-righteousness about doing this work this way that I think keeps a lot of people around here, myself included. And sometimes when the noise gets really loud, we can tap into that and just keep going in a direction we know that works. And I think that's kind of where we find ourselves right now, which is fun, cool, hard at the same time, though.
So kind of going back to the basics of what you do.
Yep.
And you know that works.
Yeah, I mean, you know, when you hear we should lock everyone up on McNeil Island and force them to do treatment, we can tell the story of, you know, we had this conversation around people with, you know, alcohol use disorder living on the streets, you know, a couple decades ago, mm-hmm. heard the same thing, and mm-hmm. we didn't. We, you know, we stayed the course and did 1811, and look at what happened. So, like, it's nice to be able to not just draw on the principles, but mm-hmm. also the experience and the evidence at the same time. Feels like we're on a good footing, even if there's a lot of noise in the background.
Right. So that did remind me of one other question, sorry. But Ricky's Law. Mm-hmm. Can you tell me kind of your perception of it? And...
Yeah, I haven't had personal experience with it. When I managed 1811 East Lake, there was an ITA law on the books for substance use disorder. And I never really understood it, to be honest with you, because I mean, I'm very familiar with the ITA law for mm-hmm. mental health issues, but and the way it was always described to me, it was involuntary treatment, and so I just never really understood what it meant. I mean, I am adamantly opposed to coercive treatment as an approach. That mm-hmm. just, it doesn't work. It doesn't seem very humane. I would say I find myself answering that in a bit more nuanced way than sometimes other people do, in that there is a balance that I think we need to be really mindful and strike. And mm-hmm. I may be drawing a little bit more on my experience around mental health treatment, but I feel confident feeling like it's similar, is where ensuring we're supporting people to have a chance to recover. I mean, that's not the way to frame it, but like suffering can reach a level where it feels like we need to find a way to support people, at least in the exact moment, that sometimes we can feel like we don't have the tools to do. And so, for example, with ITA laws related to mental health issues, you know, I fully support that we need to prioritize civil rights and autonomy of individuals' choice. That is a lot easier said than done when you're not watching somebody mm-hmm. Acutely suffering in really palpable, obvious ways. And finding ways to intervene there gets a bit more nuanced than just saying coercive treatment is bad, because mm-hmm. it is. But there are times where we need to deploy some resources. I think that makes sense, that there's room for some nuance there. But frankly, I'm not aware of a Ricky's Law example with the DSE client. I'm sure there is, but I've been too removed on that.
Right, and it might be more like Harborview folks, although I know in talking with them that they have very similar feelings about that.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the way I think about it, as I think about that answer, no one's asked me about that forever. In terms of like, is that a path to long-term recovery or long-term solutions to people's challenges? Absolutely not.
Right.
Like, right now in this exact moment, do we need to deploy something to help this person not die in the moment?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Different question. And sometimes that requires different resources
right.
or strategies.
Yes. Thank you.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for taking time. I have a few other questions, but they'll be off the record.
Okay. Sounds good.
All right. Thank you.
That's fun.